Good morning and welcome to Politics Up Close on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson. The election is 25 days away, and that means it's crunch time for Democratic gubernatorial nominee Peter Cook. The retired Army general has ramped up his criticism of incumbent Governor Gary Herbert in recent weeks, attacking his record on education funding and questioning whether Utah's economy is really as good as Herbert says it is. So what strategy does he have left in his toolbox, and what alternatives would he have to offer voters if he were to replace Herbert? Peter Cook joins me now in the studio for a conversation about his campaign. And General Cook, it's great to have you on the show.
Oh, it's good to be here. Always is.
Listeners, join us on the air with Democratic gubernatorial nominee Peter Cook. Our number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, Peter, to start off, going a few months back here, what convinced you that you had to get into this tough race to tackle a Republican incumbent in a Republican-leaning state?
Well, I feel and still feel that the people of the state of Utah believe in a real open discussion, good debate, and believe really in a two-party system. We have a track record of some great Democratic governors, and Cal Rampton and Scott Matheson, and Vince Rampton is actually my lieutenant governor, and
right.
And it shows that the people of the state can and want to have that two-party system. And everywhere I go, that decision for me to move forward is reconfirmed by people saying that one party, one voice really doesn't help our democracy move in the right direction. And so I think that decision that I made is even stronger now in as I move forward, is being reconfirmed.
Peter, are you somebody who's identified with the Democratic Party for a while now, or is it fairly recently?
Well, a lot of people don't know this, but in 1978, I ran for United States Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I was 28 years old, and now I'm 63. So that's been a long time since I've been actually involved in politics in the state. But I followed it, and putting my own business together and spending the 39 years in the military, I've been focusing a lot of my attention on my business and that opportunity to serve my country.
When you set out to run for this race, Peter, did you take into account the difficulty of winning, or did you put that aside and not consider that problem?
I think that, first of all, I don't think that any Democrat has ever run for this state and thought they could win. They eventually get there because they convince the people of the state how critical it is to really look at the issues and to be able to look at the person and to see, really the importance of having open discussion. You know, the power of the veto that the governor's office brings can bring a lot of balance to the overall way people think, how the legislature reacts, and can help in the long run really change the course of this state, which I think is at a tremendous crossroads.
This is Politics Up Close on KCPW. My guest is retired Army General Peter Cook, the Democratic nominee for Utah governor. Join us on the air with General Cook at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can also send your tweets to us here at KCPW. Peter, do you think the polls show that you are gaining any ground, that you're making a difference, and that people are supporting your campaign?
Yes. Believe it or not, it's surprising that we haven't seen any polls. We have talked to some people that are in the business who say that we are moving in the polls, and that I think in this next little bit, as we get our TV ads and put out our advertising, people will start to see, the importance and the real definition of what we have to offer versus the kick the can kind of a long concept that we have now with the present governor.
We'll go into details on the various issues, Peter, but first, more broadly, if you had to define what makes you a different person and what would make you a different governor from Gary Herbert? How would you define that?
Well, look at my experience. I've been a CEO. Mm-hmm. I spent 6 years in a formal education college. I've run not only my business, but a successful business. It was really centered around public-private partnerships, mm-hmm. helping affordable housing in our state, and then 39 years in the military, and to learn how to react in government and to work with critical issues really show that I'm not a full-time politician, but I would feel like I'm a breath of fresh air to the both ethical and thinking process that's presently being demonstrated in the governor's office.
What would you say are some of the difficult decisions you had to make in your position as the general in the Army Reserve, and how that experience would translate into the governor's role?
Well, I had 7 states, 10,000 troops. Mm-hmm. I also represented the United States Army Reserve under the Secretary of the Army during a time when we were, as reservists, 51% of the force in Iraq. I worked with joint forces throughout. That's really difficult. Some people ask me, how could you work with the Republican legislature? And I said, just come to the Pentagon and try to work with all the different services, and you can find out how complicated that is. My success in business, I started, with a business that has been successful with its ability to not only create a profit, but also to take care of an important need of workforce housing. And I just don't see that kind of experience, both in education, both in business, and then obviously serving in the military. You know, one of the most important positions of the governor is to be the commander-in-chief of the National Guard. And we have a lot of issues with a lot of our veterans coming back that need to be worked on. And I think I could do that and love to do that better than anybody presently running.
Listeners, join us on the air with Democratic gubernatorial nominee Peter Cook. Our number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at KCPW. Well, Peter, getting into the specific issues of this race, education funding really has dominated this debate once again. A very common issue in Utah politics. Would you say that this issue really is the cornerstone of your campaign, the chief reason that you're in this race?
Well, it is a very center point because from it comes our economic development, our future. Mm-hmm. Our capacity to be really a state that can be demonstrate, really facing the global economy that's really required an educated population base. The number one reason for people to really come into our state is because we have an economically viable state, and that no governor or nobody that is in state government will affect that. But what we can affect is education. And the other part of that issue is, which I think is important, we have not put out a plan. We have a road plan, and that plan shows exactly how much money is needed to maintain our roads and take care of exactly how we're going to further our transportation needs. Mm-hmm. But we have not put together an educational plan, taking our state from number 50 per pupil spending to how in the world we're going to get up to number, I've said 30, for example.
Right.
And, it seems to be it's a $2.1 billion deficit that we have to overcome. And the leadership knows that. The Utah Foundation pointed out very clearly, since 1995, our state has put money into infrastructure and has cut our taxes. Mm-hmm. Now, the demographics of this state has been out there forever. People know we had a growing population. They knew we had a growing need to educate our children, and they cut that educational budget about $150 million per year. And now we're sitting here saying that the economy, when the economy gets well enough,
right,
we'll be able to fund education. Governor said that he had $200 million. Some of that would go to education. $200 million isn't even half of enough money to take us from 50 to 49. So this state is written off education. This state has no plan, has no course, and does not have a real concern for the future of education, and it can't be demonstrated. Under my administration, within the first 4 months, we'll show a plan. We'll present it to the people of this state, and we'll show how we'll get there in the first 4 years.
When you mentioned at the debate on Thursday, Peter, that you want to move Utah up from dead last in per-pupil funding, Governor Herbert's campaign tweeted that this would take $2.2 billion to move Utah up to the national average and questioned how you would pay for this, kind of making the case that, well, you know, you talk about moving up education funding, but in reality, that would be a tremendously difficult task. What's your response?
Well, I guess in that own tweet, it shows you what I just said, that they don't believe it can be done, and they've written it off. So in that response, they have basically said, we've made a decision over the last 17 years not to fund education, and we don't plan to do it in the future. Right now, we know that we have a $27 billion budget and a $27 billion deficit in our transportation budget. How are they going to overcome that? Here's how you do that. You look at all your priorities. You present these issues to the people of the state of Utah. You look at all tax exemptions, earmarks, and expenditures. Mm-hmm. And you present it to the people of the state of Utah. And you present it in a way that shows that we may have to go there slowly. But we have to be able to have a plan. And for the governor to get up and say, I'm getting there at $200,000, $200 million a year, that's no plan. You've written it off. They have not put that together. So whatever it requires, we'll show the people of our state. And the people everywhere I go want us to get education up, because you cannot, without a good education system, have a good economic development policy. So it's sort of a chicken and egg. And if that's how the governor's office feels, then that's obvious, again, that shows that they have no priority for education.
As you mentioned, Peter, this goes hand in hand with the economy. And Governor Herbert, as you know, during this campaign and before the campaign, has been talking about Utah doing better than the national average. Indeed, our unemployment rate is below 6%, well below the national average. Do you give the governor any credit for this, or do you think that's all based on outside factors?
I believe it's on outside factors. And guess what? So does the governor. He will tell you very right off the bat that the job of government is not to create business.
Right.
And so then for him to sit on one side and say, I should take the credit for all this way this economy is growing, is so hypocritical. I don't know how we can listen to a person on one side say government should get out of really bringing in business. Then he says, look at all the business I brought in. And I outlined five audits of the state legislature from the DABC.
Right.
I went on to explain this latest one on nuclear waste. And then in the middle of that, he was trying to take somebody from Energy Solutions to have oversight. I talked about the 800,000 people that have lost their identity, and that could cost our state up to $100 million. We went through the discussion, you know, of UDOT. And every day, a gentleman last night even asked me in a meeting of the Kiwanis, how can we as a state allow a $13 million bidding process to go where it's done, and then at that same time take an $80,000 contribution from the bidder? So, where I'm quite concerned about the press keeps on pushing on the economy. That's not the job of the governor. Let business people move in our own economy. And why does he just run state government? And everybody ignores that we have the governor is under more legislative audits than any governor in the history of our state.
This is Politics Up Close. We're talking with Democratic gubernatorial nominee Peter Cook. We're going to take a short break, but you can join us on the air now. Call in at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. We'll be right back. You're listening to Politics Up Close here on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, speaking this hour with Peter Cook, the Democratic nominee for Utah governor running against Republican incumbent Gary Herbert. Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Send your tweets to us at KCBW as well. Peter, another major component of your campaign is your contention that Governor Herbert is not doing enough to protect Hill Air Force Base, a big employer in the state, from potentially closing. Well, first of all, from your knowledge, how much danger is there that Hill could actually be closed? Is there a real threat here, or is it just something that's kind of possible but not likely?
That's a very good question. The Congress and the Department of Defense, a lot of things will happen or will be determined here in the next, 26 days as mm-hmm. as how money will be appropriated and how expenditures for our defense systems will be aligned. The problem that I sensed is and brought it out to the attention of the to the people in Utah is that when the Department of Defense tells, and this is the BRAC year, that's base realignment for Air Force. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the process. It's not 1 year. In 2015, it will be an opportunity to relook at all the bases and find out what economics makes sense for the Air Force in a long-term position. And it really came to my attention as I would listen to Senator Orrin Hatch's primary to see that was obviously a concern of one of our senior senators. So I got on the phones and called some of the general officers in the Air Force and asked them really what was going on. And what we had found out that Oklahoma has taken that city, the county, and the state have all worked together to take a big part of what we do at Hill Air Force Base, kind of upgrade it, get a long-term lease from the Air Force at Tinker Air Force Base, and they moved 150 of some of our top employees out of Hill Air Force Base to Tinker, and they downgraded the general officer command from a 2-star to a 1-star, and then made Tinker Air Force Base a 3-star command. I know that's a lot of military discussion, but in a sense, it's beginning of showing their cards that they not only have signed a long-term lease with the people of Oklahoma and Oklahoma County, they've also put some of their own money to upgrade the facility of the maintenance mission that we at Hill depend upon. And so I am saying that, we need to be more aggressive. And as governor, I would be in the middle of this because Hill Air Force Base is the number one site-specific employer in our state. And it is very serious. And vigilance, as I always say, is probably the better way and the better route. And we need to find out what the long-term plan is for Hill. If it's competing with Tinker, then obviously Tinker looks like it's a step ahead and they're into the process. And I brought out a county commissioner here to show what they did, how their governor was involved and their county commission was involved to be able to really get in to the heads of the Air Force and figure out and help them go through the planning process. As a matter of fact, our press conference here made the Air Force Times to congratulate the fact that the people of the state of Utah had somebody looking out for Hill Air Force Base. So it is one of those things that very much likely could happen.
Do you think that when it comes to Hill, Peter, that, you know, we need to wait and see to some extent what the federal government actually might do before raising the alarm about the issue? Are you sure it's not too premature for, you know, Governor Herbert or whoever's in that office to be doing something here?
Absolutely not. I mean, you wait and see, the battle will be over. I mean, either, as we say in the military, either you're into that op tempo, understand what they're doing, and I'm amazed that the people here in the state have not been able to even reply about what they plan to do. Again, I feel the state has got a lot of ideas, a lot of concerns, a lot of commissions, but they keep on failing to address the brutal facts. Hill Air Force Base, we know, is potentially can be bracked in 2015. If we're overly vigilant, if we're overly prepared, that's one thing. If we're underprepared and wait and see what happens, shame on us.
Peter, you planned to hold a news conference at Hill Air Force Base to discuss this issue a few months ago, but as I ended up reading, I wasn't there. Officials didn't end up letting you do it, and you ended up having to have a press conference at a nearby abandoned gas station, from what I understand. Right. Was that a failure in coordination in your campaign? What happened there exactly?
Well, you know, it's a very classified area, and there was an MP that just thought that was a little charged up about the fact that we had TV cameras pointing in his direction. And so we decided not to push the issue any further and moved away, and it doesn't take away from the sincerity of the issue and the importance of the issue. Matter of fact, I don't even think it's worthy talking about.
This is Politics Up Close here on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson speaking with Peter Cook, the Democratic nominee for Utah governor. Elaine is calling from Salt Lake City. Hi, Elaine. What's your question or comment for Peter Cook?
Hi, General Cook. I had a question about your experience that you could bring to the governor's office. I heard the first half of the debate last night, and I've been really concerned with all of the audits and misappropriations in Governor Herbert's past 3 years, but I didn't get a very clear picture of what you could bring to the table in terms of leadership. I understand that both you and he have a real estate background, but how could that really give you the experience necessary to lead our country in a better direction? Sorry, our state.
All right. Thanks, Elaine. Good question.
By leading our state in the right direction, we also leave our country, too, so you're absolutely correct. First of all, I served in the military for 39 years and never had an IG complaint. And to me, that shows that you need to know how to run business. Now, when you say my background was not just in real estate, it was in a lot of other businesses that I've owned, and I have the experience that can make that difference. To be able to have these continue audits shows that there's a lack of ability to really understand how to run government or run a business. In my experience of not having my own business, but also understanding the importance of coordinating with a lot of different directors and people which under your administration. When I was in the Army, I had over 3,000 people that worked for me, 10,000 troops, and coordinated not only within seven states. I coordinated back in Washington, D.C., in the Pentagon. And also I've been in state government. I was the Director of Economic Development and know how to work with the legislature and what have you. These audits the thing, the most important part about these audits, they are coming from a Republican legislature telling the governor, please clean these up. His response was that this is nothing more than a little stubbing my toe. And so I would love you to have my, look at my resume and see how many years I've been in business and how long I've been in the military. And in my business alone, I'm audited by the IRS, I'm audited by the state, and I'm audited by my investors. And never have I ever, ever had a problem with that.
This is Politics Up Close. We have a few minutes left in the studio here with Democratic gubernatorial nominee Peter Cook. 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255 is the number to call. Elaine, thank you very much for your call this morning. Peter, you, a couple weeks ago, or perhaps a couple months ago now, you held a news conference to talk about the issue of values and social issues. And during that news conference, you affirmed your support that marriage is between a man and a woman, for example. There were a few other issues talked about that news conference as well. And I couldn't help but notice afterwards that there seemed to be a lot of activity on Twitter and Facebook from more progressive Democrats who said they were disappointed by this news, that they expect to have a candidate who supports more along the lines of the Democratic Party platform. Tell me about your thinking on this particular issue and, you know, whether you're worried that it might hurt your support from the base of your party.
Well, before I ran, I had a very good conversation a very open discussion with the LGBT community, mm-hmm. explaining where I was and explaining my position. And I felt very comfortable of not changing that position. It was very clear. The big issue that we were all concerned about is getting a statewide non-discrimination legislation, which I'm for and support. I don't think that I don't know of any other. I know all the other candidates running. Most of them have the same position I have. The idea was that we were going to show the state of Utah that our tent was big, mm-hmm. the Democratic Party's tent was big, and they could have Mormons, and they could have people that are, you know, Catholics, and we could have everybody. And we could demonstrate and show that we could all live and work together. And 65% of the population of our state is LDS. And I think that it was probably not what I said is how I said it at a press conference. And I apologize to anybody that thought that anyway I was trying to trying to beat a drum. I wasn't. Mm-hmm. We saw a major change in the president's position. For 3.5 years, he was opposed to same-sex marriage, and then in the last few months decided to change. And I felt it was very clear that I had to make a distinction that I had made in from the day one. And I want to say that Equality Utah, which endorsed me, mm-hmm. Stood by me, and I know they took a lot of heat from their membership. But the point was that we were trying to show that we as Democrats, who have one of the biggest caucuses in our party as LDS Democrats, mm-hmm. that we all could live together and learn together and not judge each other. And so that's the story of that issue.
This is Politics Up Close. We're speaking with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Peter Cook. Peter, we just have a few minutes left, but I do want to get onto the topic of public lands because it is such an important issue in this state. You have criticized Governor Herbert and the legislature's move to grab control of these public lands from the federal government. You refer to it as a land grab. Others have noted, however, that the first so-called sagebrush rebellion in the state, I believe, was led by a Democratic governor, Scott Matheson. What's the difference in your approach to how you view this issue? Do you view federal ownership of public lands as a problem in the state? And if so, how might you tackle it differently?
Well, you're right. Sagebrush Rebellion was started by a Democrat, and I'm going to call that Sagebrush Rebellion 1. and make it known today that Sagebrush Rebellion Number 2 has just begun. It was a pragmatic, systematic way of going to the federal government and explaining areas that we needed to be able to, as a state, to, access to some roads, access to some places of our public lands that we need to, as a state, grow to be able to have that opportunity. I've talked to some people with great experience saying that if it's approached correctly, we can get a lot of what we want. This concept of being able to go out and demand our land back, and if not, we'll sue, which is part of their program, causes a lot of, to me, conflict with our federal government and doesn't help in the process of negotiation. And if you were to look at the proposal, people don't realize that when you look at it, we get $300 million a year to run our federal lands. We get another $50 million that comes in lieu of tax monies. And then if you were to add the $50 million that we just got on the fires, that's about $400 million a year that we would have to come up with. If I was the federal government and negotiating that, I would say, listen, you better escrow 5 years of that money. So that'd be about $2 billion worth of money. And by the time we were to get around to which the legislative council says is unconstitutional, the own lawyers of the legislators are going after it say it's unconstitutional. If we were to get around to that, we would find ourselves not only having to escrow money, but then having to the opportunity to sell the property. And if we were to sell it, we only get 5%. 95% goes back to the federal government. And so to say that this is a solution that we can be able to, solve the problems of funding our education and solving that $2 billion operation is, again, playing with the people, and it's a lack of leadership, and it's just trying to stir the public opinion up to think that's an easy solution.
Peter, what lies ahead in the next couple weeks for your campaign? 25 days till the election. What are you going to be doing to get to voters, not just here in Salt Lake, but across the state?
We have worked. What's so interesting? We have gone to every parade, every city, almost every city in the state. We have knocked on doors. We're on phones. We're doing, getting our signs up, going to debates, three, and the governor won't debate me anymore. We go to other discussions, and, the surprising thing, I haven't seen the governor at one of these functions. Even last night, I was with the Granite School District, and they had meet the candidates. I was there, but the governor wasn't. They are so comfortable and confident that they're going to win this election. But guess what? We're going to surprise them. We're going to win, and because it's going to be the best thing for the people of this state.
This is Politics Up Close. My guest has been Peter Cook, the Democratic nominee for Utah governor, challenging Republican incumbent Gary Herbert. They just wrapped up their final debate last night. And, Peter, thank you very much for your time.
Well,
it's been
you.
A pleasure.
My pleasure.
This is Politics Up Close. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Up Close on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson. When you think of the Utah legislature, the words musical talents might not be the first thing that comes to mind, but Republican Representative Derek Brown of Sandy is not only an attorney and professor, but also a professional pianist. The freshman lawmaker is running for a second term in office after sponsoring bills related to issues like criminal justice and child welfare. He joins me now in the studio to talk about his accomplishments so far and what he'd like to do with another term. And Representative Brown, it's good to have you in the studio.
Thank you. Good to be here. I appreciate this.
Listeners, join us on the air with State Representative Derek Brown. Our number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, Derek, to start off, tell me a bit about your career background outside the legislature. What is it that you do, and what kind of jobs have you had here in Utah over the years?
Well, often I refer to myself as a recovering attorney. it's a breed, and anyone who's an attorney knows exactly what I'm talking about. I've practiced law in the past and left the practice of law when, a number of years ago, my family started a small business. We had kind of an interesting story. I have a niece who was born deaf, and a number of years ago, we all started learning sign language. And my wife actually had the idea, you know, let's create a show that teaches kids sign language.
Oh, wow.
And it became a program that that was on the air. It was on PBS, and we have interstitials on Nick Jr. It's called Signing Time, and it teaches children sign language, and we have a number of educational products that basically are focused on helping children communicate.
And along that front, you've been involved in some other nonprofit efforts as well. I understand you recently spent some time in Ghana. Tell me about that trip and other ways that you're involved in the community.
Well, I spent a couple of years ago. I was in Ghana with a nonprofit, and specifically working with a deaf school there, mm-hmm. and that was a lot of fun. I actually about a week ago returned from Ukraine, mm-hmm. and I was there teaching in law schools and teaching courses about the American legal system and sort of how we do things here in America. They are still in Ukraine, and in a lot of these post-Soviet countries are still struggling with the transition to democracy and what it's like. And, you know, it was just a fascinating experience to teach classes. And I had a class where we talked about the presumption of innocence and what that means. And I had students that said, well, here we have a presumption of innocence as well. And I said, well, what does that look like? What, you know, in the courtroom, what does that look like? And I had one student in a class that said, well, you know, you have the judge, you have the defendant who sits in the cage, you have the two attorneys. And I said, wait a minute, what do you mean in the cage? And it was interesting to watch all of the students kind of look at him, and he looked at the students, and they all kind of nodded and went, yeah, that doesn't really make sense if our defendant is presumed to be innocent, but he's sitting in a cage. And anyway, it was just fun to kind of talk about these concepts and help them kind of open their mind a bit.
Tell me a little bit about your career as a professional pianist. It sounds like musical talent and, you know, the arts, something that your family's heavily involved in.
It is. It's something that I did. Well, I put myself through school years ago playing piano for restaurants and weddings, recording. I spent a lot of time was in music theater with a number of different music theater. I worked at the Sundance Film Festival or the Sundance Festival. They had the outdoor theater and things like that, and came to the painful realization that providing a living for my family might be a little more difficult as a musician. And so
I can imagine.
And so I made the transition, and I after being a musician with an undergraduate degree in English literature, I did what any reasonable person would do and got a graduate degree and a law degree, and basically, you know, tried to figure out, you know, something that would actually put food on the table. So,
but it's something you've stayed involved in, though, the arts, despite your professional career?
Yes, on and off. I've had I have been involved myself, but now I have my kids actually are much more involved than I am now in those sort of things. And so
tell me a little bit about how you came to run for the Utah legislature in 2010. What inspired you to take this leap into politics?
Well, I think everyone has a moment where they think, boy, I could, you know, maybe I could make a difference. I mean, for me, it was the fact that we had an individual who was representing my area, who was the head of government relations for a labor union and our legislator simultaneously. And I heard about that and thought that can't be right. You can't here in Utah be both a legislator and a lobbyist simultaneously. That seems bizarre. And I looked into it, and sure enough, you can. And this person did. And I remember thinking, you know what? That's not right. I'm gonna throw my hat in the ring. And this person had 2 years prior had beaten the sitting Speaker of the House, and so it was quite a coup, and it was a huge undertaking, and it was a lot of work, but it paid off, and 2 years ago was the first time I ran, and the first time I won.
Was that the first time you'd ever gotten involved in politics? Did this come out of the blue, or was this something that you'd kind of been working your way up to?
No, it was something, you know, I spent a number of years when I lived in D.C., I moved there after I clerked for a federal judge, and ironically, I worked for a firm that I was recruited by a guy named Mike Lee, who at the time was an associate there at the firm like myself. And this was years before he ever ran for the Senate. And so I did that for a number of years, practiced in the constitutional law area and some intellectual property. And then I had about a 3 to 4 month trial where I didn't see my family at all. And at the end of that, I mean, it was exhausting, and it sort of came to an end. And shortly after that, I got a call from a friend of mine who worked with Senator Bennett, and he said, our legal counsel just went to a firm. Would you have any interest in working on the Hill? And I said, you know, your timing is perfect. I could use a little bit of a change after that experience. And so for a couple of years, that's what I did. I worked for the Senate, and it was just a great opportunity to get familiar with how legislation is made, how, you know, the language has a real impact, and the slightest tweak of a word in a bill, you know, has a huge far-reaching impact, and a lot of times unintended consequences. And so that here in the Utah State Legislature, that's kind of something that we always discuss when we have legislature that comes up, or legislation, is we say, what are the unintended consequences? We know mm-hmm. what we're trying to do, but for every problem you fix, there are 10 potential problems you create. And what are those, and how do we sort of put corks in each one of those issues?
Have you been involved in specifically in Republican politics for a while? I know on your website you talk about, for example, limiting federal intrusion. That's a strong principle of the GOP. Are conservative principles something you've agreed with for a while?
Yes, they have. They've been something that I feel strongly about. I feel like the when it comes to sort of the horizontal separation of powers at the federal level, judicial, executive, and legislative, we talk about that a lot. We learned that in high school civics classes. Mm-hmm. Everyone sort of pays homage to that, agrees that the tension between those branches is a very good thing. But we don't necessarily talk about the vertical separation of powers between the federal government and the state as much. And I know there are a lot of individuals who start getting uncomfortable and thinking that as a legislature we are trying to overstep our boundaries mm-hmm. and just deliberately poke the federal government in the eye. And I think sometimes we probably do that as well. And but that tension between the states and the federal government is healthy. It's a good thing. It was designed to be the same kind of tension you have between the legislature and the president. I mean, Congress and the president have that tension. That's a good thing. States and the federal government have that tension, and that's a good thing as well. And so we don't talk about it in that sense as much, but I think that's a part of the system that it's vital. And so, you know, sometimes we may sort of go out of our way, and I think there tends to be Paul Raleigh once referred to the chest-thumping noise at the legislature, and I think sometimes we do that. And, you know, I think there's good reason. I think that by and large, the attitude that we have is that someone closest to the problem is better equipped to solve the problem. I mean, any large company across the world that has to be competitive understands that the person closest to the problem needs to be empowered to solve the problem and is likely to have the best approach to solving it. And so here in Utah, we feel like, you know, on things like Medicaid, for instance, this is a huge issue, mm-hmm. and it may well be the biggest issue of the next session. We feel like we're probably in a better position to look at the efficiencies and the inefficiencies of the system here in Utah and fix them. And in fact, we feel like we can probably do it better and more efficiently than the federal government can, because we're right here.
This is Politics Up Close. We're speaking with State Representative Derek Brown of Sandy, who's running for re-election this year. Derek, what would you consider the highlights of your first two years up at the Utah legislature? I know you've been involved, for example, in child welfare and in criminal justice issues. Tell us a little bit about those and other issues that have defined your first term.
Well, I tend to take – I think my style is to simply look at – what problems do we have and how do we solve them, simply? I mean, and I am willing to have a discussion about principles that may be, you know, uncomfortable, ask questions that may be a little bit uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. For instance, there was an issue we had this last year, which is a really unfortunate, tragic incident that happened at one of the county prisons here in Salt Lake County, where someone died,
yeah.
An individual who wasn't eating. And I, as we looked at the issue, I said, you know, how do we solve this? And this is one of those areas where it happens a lot. There's some uncomfortable questions to ask. I mean, in this case, we were talking about how do you force feed an inmate who doesn't want to eat and who later dies, and there's a lawsuit stemming from that. I mean, talk about, you know, a whole series of really uncomfortable questions all in one package. So we sort of worked through that and talked about how do we create a system where, A, this doesn't happen again, and, B, we put in a series of stops to basically ensure that, that this kind of a process – there's a process in place for inmates, mm-hmm. and that their rights are looked out for. And then you overlay that on the concept of, you know, the fact that I believe you have a constitutional right to not eat. And so when you sort of put all those together, it creates, you know, a really interesting set of issues. And I feel like one of the things that I've looked at is how do we solve specific issues rather than just general, you know, concepts that tend to just make more noise than mm-hmm. a difference. That's kind of my approach. I sponsored and passed two bills this year that dealt with transparency and government records. I feel like ideally – in a perfect world, we wouldn't need grandma requests because mm-hmm. the information about what we do on Capitol Hill would be available just online. Most people that I know have never heard of the grandma requests, have never filed one, and wouldn't know where to start if they needed to. And if that information were online at the disclosures website that the state maintains, it would make accessibility to what we do at the legislature much more easier. So I had one bill specifically that did that, that brought more information and put it online. My attitude is everything we do needs to be accessible. It needs to be visible. And there are no secrets, and there shouldn't be. Everyone should be apprised of what it is that we're doing.
Derek, we have just a few minutes left, but during this last legislative session, I understand that at some point you were considering being a co-sponsor, which would have been a big deal as a Republican House member, of a non-discrimination-related bill for the LGBT community aimed at housing and employment, kind of mimicking what we've done here in Salt Lake City. Tell us about your thinking on that, and do you foresee being able to co-sponsor this legislation, and how does your thinking perhaps differ from what others in the GOP have done before?
Well, I think this goes along with what I just said about asking questions that may be uncomfortable, but mm-hmm. questions that people are asking. In this case, about 3 or 4 years ago, Salt Lake City passed an ordinance mm-hmm. dealing with non-discrimination on the same kind of thing. Other cities like West Valley have since passed this ordinance, and about a third of the state of Utah lives in a city where in the housing and employment realm, this is the law. So we right. now have sort of this patchwork of laws all over the state. Many of them are different from each other. And we have a situation now where in light of that and in light of the fact that we have groups like the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce and many businesses saying, you know, this is something we ought to talk about. Mm-hmm. The Economic Development Corporation of Utah, I talked with folks there who said, look, we try and bring people to the state, other companies here to the state, and this is an issue for them as well. Let's talk about this issue. And so essentially what I said is, yes, I'm willing to engage in this conversation. I'm willing to talk about it. I think it's an issue. At some point when you have a number of laws citywide that are on the same issue but that contradict each other, mm-hmm. at some point it may make sense to sort of harmonize those at the state level. Now, and it's not a cut and dried issue because what it would do in a sense – is have government dictate to businesses what they can and can't do. Mm-hmm. And I personally have problems with that as well. So this is not an easy issue. It's uncomfortable for many people. But at the same time, I think what we are sort of shirking our responsibility as legislators if we steer clear of an issue because it's controversial.
This is Politics Up Close. We've been speaking with State Representative Derek Brown of Sandy, a Republican who's running for re-election this year. Derek, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we've enjoyed having you on the show very much, and thanks for being on Politics
Thank
Up Close.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Politics Up Close is a production of KCBW News. Thank you to Jesse Ellis for his help with the show today. Listen to Politics Up Close every Friday morning at 9 and Sunday morning at 6, and download podcasts of our interviews online at kcbw.org. I'm Jeff Robinson. Thanks for joining us.